From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Happy New Year! On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with writer Bruce Chatwin about his travels around the world. In his latest book, The Songlines, Chatwin travels through the Australian outback and considers our urge to wander. Also today, I talk with cartoonist Matt Groening. His syndicated feature, Life in Hell, stars rabbits leading lives of hopelessness and despair. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward welcomes in the new year with some harsh words about nostalgia. And critic at large Laurie Stone shares her thoughts on the politics and sexual politics of the new film Sammy and Rosie Get Laid. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The beginning of the new year is a time to assess our lives and consider what changes we want to make. 20 years ago, my guest Bruce Chatwin examined his life and did what most of us would never dare to do. He gave up a very prestigious job and a cozy home life. He pulled up stakes to travel and write about it. His first stop was Africa, and his travels have since taken him to Iran, Afghanistan, China, the Soviet Union, and throughout Europe and South America. A New York Times book reviewer called Chatwin's 1978 book, In Patagonia, that perfect and most famous of recent travel books. After 20 years of traveling, Chatwin has come to see world history as what he calls a dialogue between the nomad and the settler. His attempt to understand the nature of human restlessness led him to Australia, where Aborigines go on nomadic walkabouts. Of particular interest to Chatwin were the Aboriginal songlines. These are the songlines passed on by the ancestors who are said to have left a trail of words and musical notes on the lines of their travels through the continent. The songlines are like musical maps that guide Aborigines through their ritual journeys across Australia. Chatwin's latest book is titled The Songlines. It's published by the Viking Press. I spoke with Bruce Chatwin from the National Public Radio Bureau in New York. Before we talked about his own nomadic life, he explained the ancient Aboriginal myth of the songlines.
The original ancestor of a particular clan is created out of a waterhole, and the mud then, at the beginning of time, and the mud then falls from his limbs, and he sets out on a journey singing the world into existence. And he is thought to have left along the ground a track of song. So each one of his footprints corresponds to a musical note. And his present-day descendants are thought to own a stretch of that song. But they'll only own a bit of it. And that puts them in relation to other people up and down the song line, which may go on for about 1,000 miles, and they will be in contact, just as we're in contact between New York and Philadelphia over the telephone. They are in contact because they actually move and sing a section of the song to each other.
Do you find the idea of singing the world into existence a very compelling metaphor as a writer?
Oh, absolutely. It's what one would hope to do. Because any artistic endeavor is supposed to be tapping into the original process of creation, or it should be, in my view, not destroying it as so much, or not saying that the whole thing is a dead end, which seems to be the preoccupation of not most at all, that's an exaggeration, but some 20th century art.
You've written in your book that, for me, the question of questions is the nature of human restlessness. And I suppose that's what got you, among other things, to study a nomadic people like the Aboriginals. But
absolutely.
What I'm wondering is that they don't really seem to be traveling because they're restless, but rather because they're desert dwellers, and if
yes.
They didn't travel, they'd be running out of food.
That is very true. The more arid conditions, the farther you have to travel. If you're in a plentiful environment, then where you don't have to travel, when everything sort of hangs from the bough, as it were, then you can, in theory, stay put. But the interesting thing is that the Australian Aboriginals did not stay put. They went out of their frontiers. They were on the move, even though they would go from very favored environments into the desert on visits and then back again. And that's the interesting question. And I don't quite know how to answer it.
Your restlessness interests me. You seem to be very restless yourself. You've been traveling for years now, and you've made a vocation of it. What makes you so restless?
I don't know. I suspect that it all... I mean, everything is supposed to happen to you before the age of three. Anyway, I was brought up wandering around wartime England in that very, very highly charged atmosphere. I was born in 1940. My first recollections are of the Battle of Alamein, of hearing Winston Churchill coming through one of those brown plastic radios and then dancing around with my mother. I was hanging onto my grandmother's legs and her stockings fell down. I deeply remember. That's one of my first recollections. But we lived out of a suitcase. All my early recollections are of, kit bags coming through windows, blackouts, and all those kind of exciting things. And we, from one set of rented rooms to another, all through wartime England. And when we then settled down after the war in those rather grim post-war years in a house for the first time, it wasn't much of a house because we had no money, I associated settlement with some kind of terrible depression. And I think whenever I've, got holed up, as it were, then my way of solving my particular crises is to move.
Well, you spent part of your early adulthood working at Sotheby's, the famous art auction house.
Yeah.
And I think you directed the Impressionism department for a while.
Roughly, yes.
But
there were others.
You gave up that life. You had a very good position.
Oh, yes.
What was there a turning point for you where you decided to give up a regular working job and to ditch it all so you could go travel?
Well, put it this way. My mother, when I left school, I wanted to travel in Africa. My mother didn't actually like the idea. My parents didn't quite like the idea of their 18-year-old son sort of dashing around Africa, but they sort of said, well, okay, fine. You could go and work in Sotheby's as a porter for a little while, and then if you don't like it, then you can go. But just sort of give it a try. So I went and I worked as a porter, and then I became a kind of instant expert. Those were the days in the art business when nobody seemed to know very much. Within a matter of no time, I was pronouncing with sort of insufferable arrogance on the authenticity of paintings, whether they were genuine or not, I don't know. But nevertheless, I had this career in the art business. But then I got a kind of psychosomatic eye complaint. My right eye went rather funny. And the eye surgeon to whom I went in London said, Bruce, I think you've been looking too closely at pictures. There's nothing wrong with you organically. Why don't you swap them for some long horizons? Where would you like to go? So I said Africa, which was the place which I'd somehow been prevented from going to before. So I went to Africa, and then I saw nomad peoples for the first time, and I felt it was quite wonderful the way in which my travelling companions had this immense pride in having nothing, whereas all our pride, or my particular pride up till then, had been towards accumulation of things and everything else.
Had you been collecting a lot of art?
Oh, yes. I had a wonderful group of things, even bought on a shoestring, but I had things which would today be worth I don't know what.
You say that in the past tense. Did you decide to sell off your collection?
Yeah, they all got paid. They all got flogged off to in order to pay for journeys one way or another. And I don't regret them. One or two things I do regret, rather. Yes.
So you were willing to throw off your collection and your possessions so you'd be freer to travel?
Absolutely. Yes, the two work against each other.
I want to quote something that you say in your book. You say psychiatrists, politicians, tyrants are forever warning us that the wandering life is an aberrant form of behavior, a sickness which, in the interest of civilization, must be suppressed. Was that attitude the one that was around you when you decided to travel? Were you discouraged from traveling?
Not really. They thought it was a bit of madness, but they always knew. I suppose my friends and family knew that I was... I like to be kind of professionally unavailable. Of course, that is kind of unacceptable if you're in business. You have to be somewhere on the end of the telephone. You have to make contact. And it seems to me to be one of the great luxuries of the 20th century is if you can be... you can make yourself unavailable. I think that's the greatest luxury I can think of.
What do you mean, like getting away from the telephone?
Yes, absolutely. Out of touch. That's the situation I like to be in.
Why do you want to be out of touch?
I just don't want... I don't want to be bothered. If I'm writing a book or whatever, you have to have your head free from all those sort of other things that get to you. Otherwise, you get sort of lured back into the web.
Most of us, when we travel, take suitcases of clothes and books. And I know some people who even take television sets and video cassette recorders so they can catch up on movies when they're traveling.
God help them, yes. God help them.
Do you travel light?
Oh, absolutely. I have a little sort of rucksack. This is, I suppose, a bit of a show-off remark, but the great and wonderful French actor Jean-Louis Barrault was somebody I met. I met him on a plane, and he had at his feet the most beautiful leather rucksack, very, very small. I mean, tiny, really tiny. And I asked him about it, and he said... I've got an apartment in Paris. I live there with my wife and everything else. But actually, this object, which I bought to go on a walking tour when I was 16 in the Tyrol in the 30s, is my home. And I have to say that I copied that, and I took a look at it, and I even found a piece of sort of string, and we sort of measured how much it was and where the pocket fitted on this thing, actually on the plane. He then went off, and he said, no, sure, of course you do that. And I had one made. And it's a kind of pillow, comforter. There's a slot in the side for a bottle. When I went to Patagonia, I put a half bottle of rather good champagne in the pocket for the worst possible moment. And otherwise, I really take nothing, hardly anything in it, just a change of warm clothes, and I'm off. And one watches, if you go into those wild places, you watch very often. You find expeditions. Of university expedition to this and that, with a lot of very bad-tempered people all looking around a Land Rover which has got stuck in the dust or the mud, and I must say I'm thankful for my little rucksack that enables me to go on to the next thing.
I love this idea of having a little bottle of champagne for the worst possible moment. What was the occasion for actually drinking it?
In Tierra del Fuego, which is one of the most sort of grisly, but it isn't so cold, but it's pretty wet. There's a constant storm going, a constant rainstorm. And I did, I was crossing one of those kind of corrugated paths of logs across a swamp. And one of the logs got dislodged, and I went in. I never thought that I'd actually come out again, this glutinous black mud, and covered from head to foot, quite cold, in the middle of absolutely nowhere. That is the moment when I sat down and drank my half bottle.
Did it taste good?
Delicious. Krug is an excellent mark.
Has the world become a more or less hospitable place to travel in since you started traveling all the time?
Hospitable or inhospitable?
Yeah, I'm asking you, hospitable or inhospitable?
Well, I mean,
there wasn't as much terrorism when you started traveling, and no. There were probably many more full-time travelers. I'm thinking of all the hippies who were traveling in the 60s.
Yes.
There's not that much traveling, I think.
I suppose not. The answer is, of course, that just as one, you know, when I was traveling in Afghanistan in the 60s, say northeastern Afghanistan, late 60s, there we'd got as far as you could go in that direction, and the idea that the China of Mao Zedong would ever be open, it was a kind of mirage, it was a sort of dream that nobody could imagine that frontier would be open. And nowadays, absolutely everyone one knows is in Tibet. I mean, you know, the South Bronx would be more exotic than Tibet, you know, most people, because every one of one's friends is sort of going anyway.
That's interesting. There's little fads in travel, huh?
Of course. But what I'm saying is that when just as one place becomes inhospitable and impossible to travel in, I mean, I don't see the chances of my being able to travel with the tribes in Iran at the moment. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I could go to see their equivalents in somewhere in Western China perfectly easily now. So just as one place folds in and becomes sort of, as it were, a terrorist zone or whatever it happens to be, then somewhere else in the world comes open. I talked to the mountaineer Chris Bonington, who was saying that, you know, certain mountains now are politically impossible to climb, but then other ones are now open. And I think that's rather the way the world moves. I reckon that we're all going to be able to travel in the Soviet Union in within 5 or 10 years. I think we're going to know what it's like to be in the Siberian forest, in the taiga of northern Siberia, and be perfectly free to move. Whereas I think that certain places which we're accustomed to going will be absolutely impossible.
My guest is Bruce Chatwin. He's a novelist and also a travel writer. His books include In Patagonia and a new book called The Song Lines, which is about the time that he spent observing Aboriginals and thinking about travel in Australia. And we're going to take a short break, then we'll be back and talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Writer Bruce Chatwin is my guest. I'm going to read something from a New York Times book review of your book. This was from the cover of the Sunday Book Review section in early August, and the reviewer was Andrew Harvey, who is also English, and he writes, "Nearly every writer of my generation in England has wanted at some point to be Bruce Chatwin. No writer has meant as much to my generation. From Mr. Chatwin, we learned to dare to be obsessive, irregular, learned, exotic, learn to burn our school ties and Wellingtons, learn to mock and avoid a literary establishment that loves to reward poems to goldfish and novels about the tepid lusts of women librarians."
Heavens. Right.
Well, Bruce Chatwin, did you feel like you were the envy of your generation when you pulled up stakes and started traveling yourself, and that you were setting an example for others?
Never. Wouldn't have entered my head. No,
really?
That's not the kind of thing that entered my head, no. It was rather funny, not so long ago, my school sent out a frantic sort of message, somebody saw it, saying that I went to a school called Marlborough, and it's one of those English public schools that everyone's read about in those rather sinister novels about boys being beaten, that kind of thing. If you went there, you're called an old Marlburian. And I was on the list of missing Marlburians. I thought it was rather emblematic.
You've been married for 22 years?
Yes.
Do you ever travel with your wife?
Oh, of course. Yes, rather. And she's a much more intrepid traveler than I am, I might say. Now, we're having a role reversal situation now. I mean, for example, I am now going back to write. I'm going to sit in France for the next few months and try and write nothing to do with travel at all, but about a man who is absolutely stuck in a bed sitting room in Prague, because that's, you know, that's, after all, another side of human life. And she, meanwhile, is going off hiking in the Himalayas and that kind of thing. So, unfortunately, writing absolutely, you know, does fetter you down to one position. I find I can't really get up steam to write a book unless I'm sedentary for some period of time, anyway.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, you were forced to be sedentary for a while pretty recently when you had a rare sickness that you contracted, I think, from a plant fungus on your travels.
Well, something like that. Nobody quite knows what it was. It was a very rare and exotic thing, they didn't know what the hell was the matter with me, and they sort of came in, until suddenly one day somebody came in and they said, they asked me all the places I had been. They said, this is something which is not recognizable anywhere. We tried everything. You must give a list of all your travels over the past 5 years. And so I said, well, you know, could I have got sleeping sickness in Brazil? Could I, you know, we went through great geographical travel, but I was a bit gaga at the time. And I neglected to tell them that I had recently been in Western China, in the province of Yunnan. And one day the doctor said, I think we've got what it is. Have you been doing one of two things, consorting with killer whales on the coast of Arabia or with peasants in Yunnan? I said, rather weakly, peasants. And that is what it was. And so I had, in fact, probably gone to a place in Western China on the Tibetan border, which had just opened up to Westerners. Then I got this particular thing. Then once they knew what that was, which was the thing that affected the bone marrow, they could prescribe the right drug, or rather the drug worked, and I came too. So that was all right.
Now I'm thinking about what a terrible profession travel would be for a hypochondriac. Think of all the...
Yes, you don't have time to think about that.
Yeah. Do you worry about that when you travel?
Not in the least, no. No, absolutely not.
I guess you couldn't travel if you did.
No, sure.
You'd be paranoid all the time.
Yes, but, I mean, people are paranoid all the time, and one just can't be bothered with it, you know. And so what? I mean, you know, you get stricken by something, and that's it.
Pop open the champagne afterwards, huh?
Yes, I think one needs another bottle. Yes.
Does illness bring out your homing instincts?
Not in the least, no. No, not at all.
I'm surprised, because I know on those rare times when I get to travel, if I get sick, I really want to go home. That doesn't happen to you?
No, this is a bit of a, you know, this is all rather a long shot. No, my immediate impulse was to get the hell out. I always have this idea that, this is rather strong stuff in a way. I always have the idea that really if one has to, I don't like those sort of end of the road scenes. I have this idea that one should really sort of step out into the wilderness and disappear. I have this great fantasy of disappearing one day, you know. Just fading out somewhere in some remote place.
Disappearing to others?
What?
Disappearing to others. I mean, you mean still having a life but not being seen by
others. Oh, that too.
Others.
Yes, I'd love that. I'd love to do that one day. That'd be great, wouldn't it? I rather hope to end my days perhaps as a sort of... Brazil is the country that I think is very nice. I have a vision. I don't think it'll come off, but I have a vision of myself being a sort of papery old English gentleman, reading at last the literature of his own country, which I don't know at all. I mean, I don't think I've hardly ever read a novel by Dickens, say. But I really want to... I'm saving them up. I want to read... I want to have the Brontes, George Eliot, Jane Austen, and Dickens particularly. I think I want to live above a cafe in Brazil and have sort of somebody take up the meals to this sort of papery old gentleman. I want to come down in sloppy white suit and a big Panama, papery looking, and sit and watch the Paseo in the evening and go up and read about English country life upstairs.
Do you think this is the kind of
mosquito,
old age befitting someone who's traveled all their life?
Absolutely.
You know, I called you, Bruce Chatwin, a travel writer earlier, and I wasn't sure if you'd bristle at that.
I'll say expression. I'm bristling now, yes. I don't see the meaning of them. I don't quite get the meaning of them. After all, the word travel, let's face it, what does travel really mean? It means, it's the same word as the French travail. It means work. And any writing is work, and so it's a form of traveling anyway. I was brought up to the notion that I think it's something to do with, if you live on little islands like we have to, I forget who said that England was that tight little island. You know, I think it was some sort of American wit during the war. And if you live there, you have two options. Either you enter into that rather closed hermetical system, or else you just treat the world as your back door. And I rather hope to do that. I just looked at the map and thought looked at atlases when I was a child and thought this is where I'm at home. And I don't necessarily see the great virtue of this word travel.
Well, obviously for you, going to different countries, different continents all the time gives you good material to write about.
Sure, absolutely. And if you're sort of floating free, people then talk to you much more. If you're unidentifiable, basically, if you're just that odd Englishman who's sort of sitting there, then people will come and tell you your stories. If you go and investigate, and you're a kind of marked man, you don't float free, and you maybe get less, I think. But to me, the fascination of travel, and you don't have to travel very far, is just to put yourself into a position whereby you're receptive to receiving stories, and providing you're receptive, they come to you. You don't have to invent. You get things which are more or less magical. I don't hold with the whole notion of the sort of fantasy in literature. I don't really like it. I don't like what's called magic realism. I think that the real is infinitely more magical than the magical.
Have you ever been in a place hoping that people will come to you with their stories, when you've noticed that, say, Paul Theroux is there too, waiting for the same thing, or another,
Paul and
another
I are great,
writer?
No, Paul and I are great friends. We're particularly telephone friends. We very rarely we rarely hitch up, but when we do, we have a kind of all-in telephone session, swapping information. And I've never met him on travels, no. Though we've covered some of the same ground.
The German director, Werner Herzog, who did the movies Aguirre, the Wrath of God, Fitzcarraldo, and a recent version of Nosferatu, is filming a movie based on one of your novels.
Right.
And the novel is called The Viceroy of Ouida?
Ouida.
Which is about a Brazilian slave trader in Africa.
Right. And Klaus Kinski is in the role.
Great.
And pretty wild he is, too. And we have 750, I think, Amazons, who are all girls from Accra. Very nice girls they were, but they got a bit riotous at times. They had lovely names. They were called Beatrice, Patience, Mavis, Maud, Rhoda. And I was sitting with them as they were stripping down, changing into their Amazon costumes, which is sort of cash sex, bit of whiting smeared on, helmet, machete. They've been trained for 8 weeks in machete drill. And spears. And we'd hear things like, take off your brassiere, Jemima, or women in Europe do not do that, Rhoda. And they were great. I liked them very much. And they nearly did stage a riot at one point, but that's beside the point. Overpay. Well, they'd gone on strike twice in order for extra pay, and then they tried to dock some of it back again, and that imposed some problems, particularly when you have they were, after all, trained to be an army, and it's rather difficult to resist that kind of pressure.
Well, movie makers are getting into some very difficult situations now, going to third world countries and paying people as extras and then finding out that the actors want more, and in some ways I think that the filmmakers are being seen as the new colonialists.
I think on the whole a good time, maybe new colonialists, but I think a good time was had by all. I mean, it was, Werner Herzog is the most remarkable character. He doesn't, on the one hand, doesn't stand for nonsense, but he's very, very fair about the dealing things. And in fact, although he pushes himself into what might be only be described as extreme situations in order to get those rather extreme movies, he himself becomes a kind of pillar of sanity in the cast of Nervous Breakdowns. Anyway.
Well, as you get older, are you still as interested in travel as you've always been? Or are you thinking of settling down?
Well, I thought I might like... Yes, I thought a few years ago that I was sort of kind of coming to the end and really it was time to sort of cross one's legs and I don't know what, take up Zen practices or something like that. I mean, just sort of sitting there or... But I have to say that the itch has got me again, and I'm off.
Where are you going?
Oh, Madagascar.
And what's the lure of Madagascar?
It's a great and fascinating situation of people who have come across the Indian Ocean. They're basically Indonesians mixed with... who have mixed with African peoples, and there's a most amazing social situation. And... Anyway, I'm hoping to go there in the fall.
Well, I wish you the best on your travels. Bruce Chatwin, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Hi.
Bruce Chatwin's books include In Patagonia and On the Black Hill. His latest book, Songlines, about Aborigines in Australia, is published by Viking. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Judith Malina. With Julian Beck, she co-founded the Living Theater, which revolutionized theater in America. Happy New Year.
When the storm clouds are riding through a winter sky, sail away, when the love light is fading in your sweetheart's eye, sail away, when you feel your song is orchestrated wrong. Why should you prolong your stay? When the wind and the weather blow your dreams sky high, sail away, sail away, sail away.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, Matt Groening, the creator of the cartoon strip Life in Hell, laughs at broken hearts, shattered dreams, and dismal futures. Also, as we begin a new year, rock and roll historian Ed Ward critiques what he thinks is one of the most dangerous impulses in rock and roll today, nostalgia. And critic at large Laurie Stone gives her views on the latest film collaboration from director Stephen Frears and screenwriter Hanif Qureshi, Sammy and Rosie Get Laid. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson in Washington. Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev and President Reagan rang in the new year together today on television. They both recorded New Year's messages to be aired on Soviet and U.S. TV. Both men promised to continue the spirit of their recent summit.
Courage is something neither of our peoples have ever lacked. We have been allies in a terrible war, a war in which the Soviet peoples gave the ages an enduring testament to courage. Let us consecrate this year to showing not courage for war, but courage for peace.
We are entering the new year with a hope for continued progress, progress towards a safer world.
In the Soviet Union, Gorbachev's speech was aired first. The messages were broadcast in between an adventure film and a variety show. In the U.S., three of the four major television networks agreed to air the speeches. CBS declined and will instead carry excerpts as part of its regular newscasts. Israeli troops fired tear gas and rubber bullets at Palestinian demonstrators today and put three refugee camps under curfew. Thousands of soldiers and police patrolled both the West Bank and Gaza Strip on this Fatah Day, marking the first operation against Israel by PLO leader Yasser Arafat's Fatah group in 1965. In Tel Aviv, Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir said a limited number of Palestinians involved in anti-Israeli riots in the occupied territories would be deported despite U.S. protests. Shamir said, "We have become accustomed over the years not to listen to pressures or interference." The truth about Britain's worst nuclear plant accident has come out. Government documents released today show that Britain censored a report about a fire at the Windscale nuclear reactor in 1957, apparently out of fear that the United States would refuse to share atomic secrets if it knew about the disaster. The fire contaminated a 200-mile area and prompted the government to temporarily ban milk products near the plant. Up to 33 deaths may have resulted from the contamination. A fire in a tourist hotel in Bangkok has killed at least 13 people. One of the victims was a woman who fell to her death from a helicopter trying to rescue her. Neil Kelly reports.
The woman's husband watched as she fell 9 stories onto another building. Police said she died instantly. Later, the husband explained that they had been waiting 2 hours to be rescued. Flames were only a few yards away when the helicopter arrived and hovered alongside a narrow ledge where they were stranded. He got in first to help his wife and others across the narrow gap between the ledge and the helicopter. As it veered away suddenly, Mrs. Jane Tai from Melbourne clutched desperately at the landing skid. Her husband David said she hung on for about 10 seconds before falling. Her arm was not strong enough, and the helicopter was moving quickly, he said. Other foreign tourists, including 3 Singaporeans and an American, are among the dead. The fire began on the second floor, as hotel guests were still celebrating the new year. The fire swept to the upper floors, forcing people onto the roof and gutting most of the rooms before it was brought under control.
Neil Kelly reporting for the BBC from Bangkok. The Philippine Army has accused the communist rebels of killing a local candidate for mayor. The man was shot at point-blank range by 2 men after he finished a campaign speech yesterday. The shooting shattered the unilateral New Year's ceasefire called by President Corazon Aquino. Besides being a member of Aquino's party, the man who was killed was also an organizer of the anti-communist vigilante movement. Austrian President Kurt Waldheim's New Year's message today was about the lessons of his country's Nazi past. He urged Austrians to take advantage of the 50th anniversary of the incorporation of Austria into Hitler's Germany to think about how to avoid racial hatred. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. For some of us, letting go of one year to ring in the new can bring on an acute case of nostalgia. Our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward, says that some people come down with the same symptoms when they listen to vintage rock and roll, and he'll have none of that.
Hey kids, remember this great hit? Just got a press release from Warner Brothers Records. It reads, Gold Pistols. Never mind the bollocks, here's the Sex Pistols. The landmark album from Britain's punk music progenitors has been certified gold by the Recording Industry Association of America, signifying sales in excess of 500,000 units. Imagine that. It took 10 whole years for an album that revolutionized rock and roll to sell as many copies as Bon Jovi sells in a month. But that's not the point I'm trying to make here. Ask yourself this question. How did you feel when you heard me play God Save the Queen a minute ago? I guess the answer depends on how you felt about punk the first time around, or what you were doing and thinking in 1977. Most of the punk rockers I knew back then are married or settled down, but nearly all of them have a deep affection for those days. It was one of those times when young people in the audience realized that they had the power to create their own culture and then went ahead and did it. A lot of it was amateurish and downright bad, but it was fun doing it. Now, some of you may be sitting there shaking your heads, asking yourselves, am I really feeling nostalgic about the Sex Pistols? And I can't speak for Johnny Rotten, or John Lydon as he's known these days, but I sure hope you aren't. As one year passes into another, I think it's an appropriate point for me to declare that as much as I love presenting rock and roll history on this show, I don't do it for nostalgia's sake. Nostalgia is stupid. Nostalgia is something that greedy people use to sell you things you don't really want. Nostalgia is a very dangerous thing, and I won't have any part of it. Paul McCartney once wrote a song in which he sang these words, Yesterday all my troubles seemed so far away. Now it seems as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. No, you don't, Paul, and I don't think you did then either. I mean, the original name for the tune was Scrambled Eggs, but yesterday fit too. But there are people who persist in believing that if Paul and his two surviving bandmates would just get up on a stage again, somehow things would revert to some previous idyllic state and trouble would vanish. Yeah, sure. Paul McCartney still writes and sings new songs. So does John Lydon, whose band Public Image Limited has a hit right now with a song called Seattle. And since the breakup of the Sex Pistols, Lydon's music has gotten better and better, at least in part because he doesn't dare believe in yesterday. I listen to Duke Ellington a lot. I also listen to a lot of Mozart. If I said that was nostalgia, people would think I was nuts. After all, Mozart had been dead for 157 years before I was even born. And if I wandered around Harlem in the 30s in a previous life, nobody's ever told me about it. No, the whole purpose about rock and roll history, to me, is to see what good stuff is out there that you might have missed the first time around, or that might have happened before you were born. I really hope some 16-year-old kid has gotten turned on to Sonny Burgess's nutball rockabilly or Escarita's manic piano pounding by this program, or that some 40-year-old goes back and picks up the Sex Pistols album and realizes that it's got the same kind of crazy energy that all the best rock and roll has. I hope that people realize that rock and roll history is still happening, that there are great bands out there today, not just on the top 40, but in little clubs all over the country, banging out rock and roll that may well stand up in 10 years. We're in sort of a lull these days. There's no Elvis, no Beatles, no Sex Pistols to engage our attention, so it's easy to fall back and let the hucksters on TV sell us Fabian albums in the name of the good old days. Hey, save your money. Pick up the paper and see if Dave Alvin and the All-Nighters, or Glass Eye, or the Wild Seeds, or Wayne Toops and Zyta Cajun, or the Silos, or Joe Ely, or whatever the local hotshot in your area might be, is playing, and spend your money on that. Johnny Rotten was only half joking when he said, no future, just as Paul McCartney was. Speaking strictly as a rock and roll historian, I can't wait to see what 1988 brings.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine.
That's R.E.M. singing It's the End of the World as We Know It. Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, the Rolling Stone history of rock and roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. As you heard, Ed's listening isn't limited to rock and roll. This is one of his favorites from his jazz collection, Duke Ellington's The Mooch. This is Fresh Air. It's a new year, but for cartoonist Matt Groening, it's still Life in Hell. Groening has ushered in the new year with a Life in Hell 1988 fun calendar featuring all the characters from his Life in Hell syndicated cartoon strip. The strip stars assorted crudely drawn rabbits and appears in more than 60 newspapers, mostly alternative weeklies. Groening has collected his strips in four books, including Love is Hell, Work is Hell, and his latest School is Hell. I'll let Groening describe his cast of characters.
I only draw rabbits and a couple of humanoid figures. My main rabbit characters are Binky. He has very bulgy eyes, sort of a button nose, and extremely prominent teeth. He's based on a guy I went to college with. And then he has an illegitimate son named Bongo, and Binky's estranged girlfriend is named Sheba, who's basically Binky in drag. It's a part of a long tradition in cartooning to do female versions of the male characters just by giving them eyelashes and a bow on top of their heads. I'm thinking, of course, of Minnie Mouse and Daisy Duck. And then I have my two humanoid figures, Akbar and Jeff, who are either brothers or lovers, or perhaps both. And they wear fezes, and they have very big noses, and they have both eyes on the same side of their head. And they're based on a clumsy attempt at drawing Charlie Brown when I was a kid. My friends and I used to try to imitate the Peanut strip. And we could never get Charlie Brown to look anything like Charlie Brown. So it sort of mutated into Akbar and Jeff.
You make it sound like you don't draw very well.
Well, let me put it this way. No, I was the worst drawer of all my friends. But I stuck with it. Yeah, I'm slightly ashamed of my drawing. When I get together in a room full of cartoonists, I'm the one that is standing in the corner with my head hanging down.
Your new book is called School is Hell, Is school as hell based on your memories of school?
School was hell for me, and I think it was hell for virtually everybody who probably hears this. In fact, I think that if you don't think school was hell or is hell, then either you have a very bad memory or you're responsible for making school hell for someone else.
Well, look, if your basic premise is that life is hell, then it only follows that school is hell and work is hell and everything is hell.
Well, yeah. Yeah. But school really is hell. I mean, life is swell. But school, you know, I mean, it's got some good points. But for the most part, I mean, I'm thinking of my own life experience. I was not guilty of a lot of the things I was accused of. I didn't drop the encyclopedia out the window. I didn't throw that rotten apple at Julie and hit her in the face when she had a broken leg. I didn't put up obscene posters around the school. And those were just the things that I was accused of that I wasn't guilty of that I got punished for. Just think of all the things that I was guilty of that I got punished for. I mean, it was endless, and I resented being punished for the things that I had done, but I really resented being punished for the things I hadn't done.
Were you ever punished for drawing cartoons in class?
Well, I had a teacher. In fact, it's referred to in my fifth grade diary in School as Hell. He liked to confiscate my cartoons. He'd wait until they were almost completed, and then he would snatch them from my desk. And
you make him sound very sadistic.
Oh, no, he was a really nice guy. He was the guy that used to draw on the blackboard a little chalk circle and make me stick my nose on it when I had done something like talk during class or something like that. And the bad part wasn't so much having your nose stuck on the blackboard. It's when he raised the circle, inch by inch as the year wore on. And I wasn't growing at that quite a rate.
When did you start thinking seriously of being a cartoonist?
Well, my father was a cartoonist before I was born. He drew those kinds of cartoons where prospectors are crawling across the desert dying of thirst and people are cast away on a desert island and the bottles float up and all those kinds of gags. So I think I got something from him. He also gave me a lot of marker pens. But like I said before, I never really could draw much of anything except rabbits. And so I had no idea that that I would do this as a career. Fortunately, I went to a really wild college, and that was called the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and that had no grades, no required courses, no tests, no fraternities, no sororities, no football team, and no jobs upon graduation. But the best thing about it was that it allowed me to do whatever I wanted to do, and one of the things I did was work on the school paper, and that's where I met another cartoonist, Linda Berry, who draws cartoons for Esquire and has a syndicated comic strip called Ernie Pook's Comic in papers around the country. And she and I cartooned together, and we stuck the cartoons in the paper, and that's basically how I got my start. She was my mentor. And tormentor, too.
You got your start in alternative papers, and as a matter of fact, you still are in a lot of alternative papers. How do you think the standards for cartoons differ between alternative papers and the dailies that carry comics?
Well, I never get censored in an alternative paper, and in some of the daily comic newspapers that I'm in, there is a little bit of pulling back. You can only push them so far, and then they'll get upset. In fact, one paper wanted me to change the title of my comic strip from Life in Hell to Life in Heck because they thought it would just be a little too much for their readers.
You have a series of comics of covers of specialty magazines that you've invented. One of them is called Starving Artist Magazine, and one of the lead stories is how to cope with reading about wildly successful artists who are younger than you are. You make fun a lot of tortured, sensitive artists and striving artists. Have you ever thought of yourself as a starving artist?
Starving, yes. I sort of made this vow a long time ago that I would not use the word art in conjunction with cartoons because it seems like every time people talk about cartooning and they have to justify it to other people, they always say, oh, well, cartooning is literature or cartooning is art or whatever. And in my opinion, cartooning ain't art, ain't literature. It's just cartoons and it's peripheral stuff. Cartoonists are not ready for some of the more sophisticated art forms, and they tend to resent serious art because it's not wacky enough. And so they do go through life, I'm, of course, not like that at all. They do go through with life vaguely resentful and kind of squinting at the rest of the world as it goes by, ignoring them.
Recently, you started doing animation for the Tracy Ullman Show. How does the animation that you're doing compare to the comics that you do, the cartoons that you do?
With the drawing, it's just me sitting alone at a desk, you know, trying to keep the sweat from dripping off the end of my nose onto the page. And with an animated cartoon, I work with lots and lots of people, and it's definitely a collaborative effort.
How do the characters you've created for that compare to the rabbits that you do in your cartoons?
Well, they have the same bulgy eyes, and they have the same little button cute noses, and they have the same kind of very tragic overbite. But they don't have the big ears, except perhaps the mom, who has a giant bouffant hairdo, and she probably is concealing rabbit ears underneath. Perhaps in the last show I will reveal that she's actually a rabbit. It's a family called the Simpsons. Bart Simpson, Lisa Simpson, Maggie Simpson, and mom and dad. And they're sort of mutant 50s, father's knows best family in hell. It's sort of a running theme in my stuff.
Is being a cartoonist hell?
Not at all. I had to be a cartoonist or something equally frivolous. And so every day that I'm able to sit down and get to draw goofy, bulgy-eyed rabbits instead of something else, I feel very lucky.
Matt Groening, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Cartoonist Matt Groening spoke with us from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. His latest works are the book School is Hell and the Life in Hell 1988 Fun Calendar. Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with Renee Montaigne, the co-host of the program. Happy New Year, Renee.
Happy New Year, Terry.
What do you have coming up?
Well, tonight we look back a little bit. First, a look back at the favorite music releases of 1987. We'll talk to a number of people in and outside of the music industry to find out their pick of the year. And among those we talked to, movie director John Waters likes Marianne Faithfull's Strange Weather. He describes this music as cocktail music from hell. Those are his words, now not mine. Political reporter Linda Wertheimer looks ahead to campaign 88. She says the Republican race has pretty much narrowed down to Vice President George Bush and Senator Robert Dole, but there's no predicting what the Democrats will do.
Okay, well, thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our critic-at-large, Laurie Stone, just saw the movie Sammy and Rosie Get Laid. It's about sex, class, politics, and cross-cultural encounters in England.
While watching the movie Sammy and Rosie Get Laid, I felt bubbly and hopeful. It was made by the team who did My Beautiful Laundrette, writer Hanif Qureshi and director Stephen Frears. It's a movie for grown-ups, resolutely serious in subject matter, but freewheeling in form. At a time when most movie makers are turning their backs on ambivalence and giving us one-dimensional characters, here is a film in which everyone has conflicting, unresolvable sides. While most movies show blacks or whites, and of course mostly whites, here is a movie that celebrates the mingling of races. It's about politics and sex, and it gives you the feeling, the way Godard's movies in the late 60s did, that sex has a politics and that politics is sexy. It sends a screw you to Reagan and Thatcher. It also sends a screw you to people who treat art like a rug, something to purchase, not be changed by. At the beginning of the movie, London police charge the flat of a black woman. They're looking for her son, but she panics and throws grease on them, and they shoot her dead. The act sets off a race riot, and into this brick-tossing, car-bashing maelstrom walks Rafi, a Pakistani politician. Rafi is played by the superb Indian actor Shashi Kapoor. He's a charmer, a chameleon. He hasn't seen London in 30 years, but he can stay afloat in this post-empire soup of races and ethnicities. He wants to make peace with his son, Sammy, who works as an accountant for artists but has chosen to live in the fringe area where the rioting is taking place. Sammy is married to Rosie, a social worker and feminist. She admires Rafi for helping to lead a revolution against the British, but when she finds out that he was a torturer in the subsequent corrupt regime, all hell breaks loose. The inner conflict of the characters matches the violence on the streets. The movie moves like a web of interlocking dreams. Some sets have documentary realism, others Hollywood flash. The plot is too complicated to unfold here, and the full cast too numerous to describe. The movie doesn't tell you how you're supposed to feel about the partly likable and partly repellent characters, but one thing it makes clear is that the post-colonial influx of races is the most promising thing to happen to Britain in 50 years. In the most graphic and fanciful embodiment of this idea, the screen becomes a triptych, and three interracial couples have sex. They're serenaded by a quartet of Rastafarians who do a reggae version of My Girl, complete with Temptations moves. The sequence is sexy and witty, but I have one quarrel with it, and with the way sex is treated throughout the movie. In the heart of London, a city inundated with safe sex ads, the socially conscious characters in this movie take no precautions against AIDS. They don't even mention the disease. While the right blames AIDS on sexual freedom, Frears and Qureshi, by not challenging this charge, come off treating HIV virus as if it were right-wing propaganda, something that will fade away under the left. This is precisely what won't happen, what isn't happening. But if left-wing artists and politicians don't at least address the existential fears AIDS raises, the only voice people will hear is that of reaction. Sammy and Rosie Get Laid is an inspiriting romp, but the hysteria about AIDS inside it takes the form of complete denial, and this silence is definitely dispiriting.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and is a contributor to The Village Voice.
I've got sunshine on a cloudy day. And it's cold outside. I've got the month of May.
Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, another in our series of interviews with Fresh Air contributors. I'll speak with our rock historian, Ed Ward, and we'll find out how rock and roll became an important part of his life. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review the new album from pianist Mulgrew Miller and his quintet. And television critic David Bianculli will review EastEnders, a contemporary drama about the working class in London's East End. It's been the most popular serial drama in Britain, and it's coming to American public television. I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance today from Lisa Bruton and Janine Colgren-Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Vablaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross, and on behalf of all of us at Fresh Air, I wish you a very happy New Year. This is NPR, National Public Radio.